Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Andra Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author who examines the Heritage Foundation's Project Esther being implemented by the Trump regime to dismantle and criminalize the U.S.-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Alan Minsky, executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, who discusses the Democratic Party's failure to effectively challenge Trump and the Republicans on constitutional authoritarian abuse of power. And Umi Hawk, an organizer with Defend and Recruit, who talks about the growing boycott campaign across the U.S. targeting Avelo Airlines over its contract with the Trump regime to fly ICE deportation flights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
This year, 75 of the poorest nations around the world owe China over $22 billion in debt for loans Beijing made in their Belt and Road Global Infrastructure Initiative. The program lent developing nations funds they needed to build schools, bridges, hospitals, highways, and shipping and airports. This makes Beijing the largest supplier of bilateral loans, peaking with a total of more than $50 billion in 2016, more than all Western creditors combined. Australia's foreign policy think tank, the Lowy Institute, calculated the debt owed to China has made Beijing more of a debt collector than a banker to the developing world. The pressure to repay these Chinese loans has put a strain on these nations' ability to fund healthcare and education programs, as well as climate change mitigation. The Lowy report said the record high debt now owed to China could be used for political leverage, noting that it comes amid the Trump administration's deep cuts to U.S. foreign aid programs. But the situation also puts China in a bind, with conflicting priorities between diplomatic pressure to restructure unsustainable debt in impoverished nations and domestic pressure to demand repayment of loans amid China's own economic downturn. House Republicans passed their proposed federal budget by just one vote on May 22nd, with a total of $1.5 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, Medicare, and the SNAP food assistance program in order to pay for enormous tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans. Earlier in the budget debate, a dozen House Republicans vowed to oppose reductions in Medicaid, citing concerns about the potential impact of gutting the program on health care providers across the country. But in the end, six GOP representatives dropped their objections and voted for the budget. The American Prospect reports on one budget provision that may explain why. Buried deep in the 1,100-page budget was a change to the qualified business income deduction that raises the percentage of tax deductions from 20 to 23% for rental and business income. According to an analysis of annual federal disclosures, six of the Republican lawmakers who dropped their opposition to the GOP budget's Medicare cuts could each benefit from the changes, which is projected to cost $780 billion in lost tax revenue over the next decade. The Prospect charges these six legislators with selling out hundreds of thousands of their own constituents who will lose Medicaid benefits while voting to collect a large tax break for themselves. In the weeks after deadly wildfires engulfed Los Angeles neighborhoods in January, some small steps have been taken to rebuild historic homes owned by African Americans lost in Altadena to the Eaton Fire. The fire destroyed more than 6,000 homes occupied mostly by middle and working-class families, many of whom had been in those houses for generations. The fire, which killed 18 residents, also destroyed Altadena's business district, as well as schools, churches, and synagogues. However, the disaster recovery is facing major obstacles, as many residents' insurance will only cover 60 or 70% of what they've lost. Another major problem is the Trump administration's slashing of funding for the Department of Housing and Urban Development and FEMA, federal agencies which have for many decades been essential partners for rebuilding communities struck by natural disasters. The Nation magazine reports that a sign of hope can be found in several architectural firms offering residents of color pro bono services that include permit-ready plans for accessory dwelling units with garage or in-law apartments that can be built simply and quickly, bypassing the city's bureaucratic red tape. The architect's goal is to assist less affluent homeowners build rental units that would contribute to their economic stability while reducing the shortage of affordable housing in these now destroyed neighborhoods. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
During the 2024 presidential campaign, there was quite a bit of media attention paid to the right-wing Heritage Foundation's 900-page Project 2025 that advocated hundreds of policy positions for candidate Donald Trump and a blueprint for his administration should he win the election. Although candidate Trump denied knowing much of anything about Project 2025, that quickly changed once he was back in the White House. Trump's second presidential administration has closely followed many of the policies advocated by authors of Project 2025, including the elimination of entire government agencies, the mass firing of government workers, slashing of the federal budget, mass deportations, and dismantling of DEI programs. In fact, many of that document's authors have joined Trump's administration, including Russell Vogt, a principal Project 2025 architect who was picked by Trump to direct the powerful Office of Management and Budget. Far less attention has been paid to another Heritage Foundation document called Project Esther, drafted after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Project Esther outlines a strategy for dismantling the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the U.S. by falsely conflating all criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism and support for terrorism, proposing a program of surveillance, propaganda, and deportation. The Trump regime is closely following Project Esther's plan by targeting students protesting against Israel's genocide in Gaza, deporting non-U.S. citizens involved in pro-Palestinian activism, and withholding funds from universities. Your reporter spoke with Andra Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author whose recent column, titled Project Esther, Where Dissent Equals Terrorism, warns that the Heritage Foundation and Trump's ultimate plan is to equate all dissent with terrorism in order to target anti-MAGA activists and groups for suppression and censorship.
Project Esther is named after a biblical character called Esther. In the Jewish faith, the Feast of Purim is a celebration of her life and what she did for the Jewish people in saving them from genocide. So it's ironic that Project Esther is named after her to persecute people who advocate against a different genocide against the Palestinians. The reason the Heritage Foundation and Christian nationalists are eager to support Israel and use Project Esther to define anti-Semitism in the United States is because the existence of the nation of Israel as a nation is central to their end times last days prophecies in the Bible. It was one reason why they decided to move the U.S. Embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Nominating Mike Huckabee to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel is another underscore of this end times last days beliefs that permeates a document like Project Esther, where Israel has to be an intact nation that exists in its historical fashion for their Bibles to come true and their last days prophecies to come true. Mike Huckabee subscribes to those prophecies as well. Christian nationalists, and there are different flavors of Christian nationalists, but they all believe that we are living in the last days of the earth. We have a bunch of people now in government, the federal government, like Russell Vogt, who subscribe to these beliefs, like Pete Hegseth, like Mike Johnson. I mean, there are over 100 of them just in Congress who believe that this is what we're living in. Project Esther's underpinnings try to ensure that the biblical historical maps of the nation of Israel remain intact, that Palestine becomes part of that, so that their last days predictions of Bible apocalypses can come true.
Andre, I wanted to ask you about the conflation that we've seen of any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism and even terrorism, and that's outlined in Project Esther. Tell our listeners a bit about your concern that Project Esther is not just focused on repressing anti-Semitism, but repressing dissent in general that extends to anyone in this country who dissents from the policies of Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
Well, so on page 20, Project Esther devotes three subsequent pages to every step they have to take to achieve their desired end state of having all of this kind of dissent be labeled terrorism. So even though these other groups aren't named in Project Esther, they've already attacked academic institutions and academics who refuse to teach regime viewpoints or dissent in their own curricula. And that's not just with Gaza and Palestine. That could be with DEI. It could be with women's studies. It could be with LGBTQ. It could be with teaching what fascism is. We've already seen three academics leave the United States over that. They've targeted foreign faculty who are coming here and foreign researchers who are coming here to do work by stopping them at the airport and refusing them entry for posting things on social media that were critical of the regime. They're targeting foreign students heavily and have revoked foreign student visas for multiple countries. They are revoking public federal funding, grant funding and other funding, for major universities because of supposed opposition to the regime and its principles. Those are examples of things where they have taken these desired end states that are listed in Project Esther as making dissent terrorism and applying those things to other things that have nothing to do with anti-Semitism across the board. They've also made noises about targeting ACT Blue. So one of the things that Project Esther outlines is cutting off the ability for any group to raise money or be able to attract support if it supports things that are antithetical to what the regime wants. And they've targeted politicians who advocate for those things as well. They've charged one politician formally with a crime for exercising her right to inspect an immigration facility. They arrested someone at a Democratic politician's office, Jerry Nadler. So we're seeing them apply these Project Esther talking points far beyond the world of Gaza, Palestine, Israel, Hamas.
That was Andrew Watkins, a New York Times bestselling author who writes the Substack page for such a time as this. Find a link to her examination of Project Esther and related analysis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Almost 5 months after taking back the White House, Donald Trump and his regime are working at a frenetic pace in a deliberate attempt to demolish the foundations of American democracy. From their unconstitutional dissolution of entire federal agencies, illegal firing of tens of thousands of civil servants, deportation of migrants and even U.S. citizens without due process, conducting a white supremacist-inspired attack on diversity that's erased the accomplishments of blacks, Latinos, LGBTQ community and women from federal websites, libraries, and museums, threats made against judges, and lawsuits funding cuts and arrests driven by revenge, that's targeting law firms, universities, news outlets, artists, politicians, and anyone who dissents from MAGA's authoritarian agenda. All these tyrannical actions and more are occurring on a daily basis, while the Democratic Party, the nation's major opposition bloc, is perceived by millions of Americans to be weak, disorganized, and incapable of launching an effective response to Trump and the Republicans' assault on the rule of law in civil society. A recent poll found that only 27% of voters say they have a positive view of the Democratic Party. For several months, progressive groups RootsAction.org and Progressive Democrats of America have called on the Democratic National Committee to convene an emergency national meeting of its members, open to the public, to strategize on ways to effectively confront the predatory, extreme, and dictatorial actions of the Trump administration. Despite growing dissatisfaction among their base, the DNC's executive committee met on May 30th in Arkansas, but took no action. Your reporter spoke with Alan Minsky, executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, who talks about what he believes Democrats must urgently now do to confront Trump and the GOP's unconstitutional abuse of power.
Why the petition? Because we're at a state of emergency where the Democratic Party, I think, is going through its extended stretch of the lowest public opinion polls ever. We've heard whisperings from sort of the consultancy class and leaks. Carville sort of said and then retracted, well, the strategy is just let Trump destroy the country and we'll win the midterms because it'll be so horrible. And I think that's somewhat the general sentiment that people feel about the Democratic Party. I think the base of the Democratic Party is cognizant of the damage being done by Trump. And we've all seen Trump's opinion polls themselves go down. Public opinion polling for the Republican Party is not very high either, though it's not as low as it is for the Democrats because of the MAGA base still supporting Trump. But the response has not been well short of heroic, that there's an appetite among the Democratic Party establishment to not really announce this as a, you know, catastrophic moment, but to go along to expect a victory in the midterms. And that's rather appalling considering the nature of the crisis. And I think that Sanders and the Fight Oligarchy Tour are an absolute night and day contrast. People recognize that Sanders is taking his public policy platform out to the public. He is announcing that the great discontent with the political establishment that led to the election of Trump is not going to produce anything that will rectify the central economic and social concerns of the American people, that his platform will, and people are responsive to it. But the Democratic Party establishment, of course, is not supportive of the Sanders platform. And this speaks to a split within the Democratic Party, again, in which I think a minority faction that is supported by the majority of money that flows into the coffers of the Democratic Party is at odds with the base of Democratic Party voters. Right. And this is why we are calling for an emergency session. We think if the Democratic Party, broadly speaking, not only stands up and makes clear to the American public about the nature of the constitutional crisis and the crisis for our political and entire social and economic system that we're living in, the freedoms that we have assumed to be a part and parcel of life in America are under threat, and combine it with clarity, a set of economic proposals that will improve the lives of the average American, they're not going to produce the same size of the deficit as what Trump is putting on the table right now. Arguably, of course, in a progressive Keynesian way, you'll generate a larger tax base if you have generalized prosperity among the working class and the middle class, which, of course, is the proposal that we put forward. I mean, dissatisfaction with the cost of housing, the cost of college, the cost of childcare, the absolutely atrocious healthcare system and inhumane healthcare system we have in the society, these are not being addressed, only being made worse by Trump's policies.
So I guess the big question hanging over the Democratic Party, given the fact that the leaders of the House and Senate basically remind us all the time that they don't have any power in those bodies, they say, because they're outvoted. But what would you have Ken Martin and the Democrats do at this point to try to dramatize the urgency of opposition to this authoritarian takeover we're seeing proceed day by day by the Trump regime?
The public wants to see a rebirth of the Democratic Party. But look, what are the countervailing forces in the Democratic Party? We know what they are. And that's that the party is largely split ideologically. We as progressives, we have to try to convince, cajole, persuade even careerist Democratic centrists to join with moving the party to the progressive left. The necessity of doing it, how it will be good for society. I imagine many of them will not follow with us because they are committed to a Democratic Party that raises all this money from corporate America and wealthy Americans, who, of course, do not want to see a transformation of our socioeconomic system along more populist lines, which would serve the average person. We can convince the people in charge of the DNC to embrace it, to show the public that the Democratic Party will be responsive to their needs across the entire country, from rural America, small town America, to the urban core, to people who are living precarious lives in the once prosperous suburbs. In other words, for the 80% of the population, and not prioritize an economic and social agenda that is a status quo agenda, but it requires the mobilization and enthusiasm of the general public to engage with the Democratic Party in that way. And a first step would be the call for an emergency meeting that we've asked to be called for.
That was Alan Minsky, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America. Learn more about the petition calling on the Democratic Party to convene an emergency meeting to develop a strategy to confront Trump and the GOP's authoritarian attack on democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Avelo Airlines is the only known commercial carrier that's operating deportation flights from the U.S. under contract with the Trump administration's Department of Homeland Security. One of the airline's passenger hubs is in New Haven, Connecticut, where it's grown from a few flights to as many as 14 per day, mostly to the southeast and Puerto Rico. When the company announced it was hiring flight attendants for its deportation flights departing from Mesa, Arizona, that were to begin in mid-May, local activists began a weekly protest outside Tweed New Haven Airport. They launched an online petition that's garnered almost 39,000 signatures of support for a boycott, many from people in other cities that Avelo flies from. Avelo's CEO has openly stated the company took on the deportation flights to pad its bottom line, especially as it's encountered more competition, which has cut into the company's profits. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Umi Hawk, a Texas-based organizer with the Defend and Recruit Network, an immigration defense project of Siembra in North Carolina. Here she describes growing support for the Boycott Avelo campaign, culminating most recently in a national week of action from May 27th to June 5th that involved protests in more than 40 cities.
So we've been kind of watching some of the protests online, seeing the incredible work in Connecticut and the responses that they're getting, since that's obviously one of Avelo's main base locations. And we saw that there were a couple more happening and could really see that this is something that people wanted to get engaged in and that there's a real opportunity here in terms of the fact that Avelo has made it so clear that they took this contract for financial reasons. And there's obviously all this outrage across the country. So it seemed like an opportunity to bring more folks together to put more pressure on Avelo. So that they actually drop this ICE contract.
Is it easy for people in other cities to boycott Avelo because they have other options?
In some places, it's Avelo's the only company, and in others, there are other options. A lot of the flights that they're flying are flown by other carriers like Budget, or Southwest Airlines has a lot of the same coverage map as well. And both of these companies haven't taken on signing an ICE contract. And then even in places where people can't find it easy to find another carrier, so for instance, in Delaware, where that is actually the only operator out of that airline, the governor is still saying he won't fly Avelo because of moral reasons. And he's going to, you know, actually drive the extra whatever it's going to take to go to a different airport to be able to make sure that they're flying a different carrier. So I think that's one of the really inspiring things we're seeing, too, is for people who, like others who are finding it just a little inconvenient, they're still willing to do it to make a point. So that is really important and powerful in these times.
From what I know, and I haven't researched it, but just from news reports, I know that Avelo flew at least one flight to El Salvador, and I know they took a flight to Guatemala more recently. What do you know about how many flights they've done and where the flights have gone?
So the flights are notoriously hard to track, and purposefully so. They're definitely trying to operate by stealth. I think the two that you mentioned and that sort of flight path are the ones that we're most aware of.
Do you have any direct information about, or anybody that you work with have direct information about what it's like for those people who they take on those flights? I've heard that they're handcuffed and chains around the waist. That's like really heavy duty, a kind of security. And it's pretty scary to think if there was a problem, what would happen? Do you know if they are in fact at that level of security or not?
That's our understanding. The airline union, I'm sure you've seen their statement, has already come out saying that they're concerned about the health and safety around these flights. There's a great ProPublica article I'm sure you've seen around the conditions of the flights and what we understand from folks. And we have heard from some people who are airport workers and then also from the things that we see online as well, that they're horrific flights for people on them. And that, yes, the people on them are shackled. They're not able to access toilets at times. If there were to be some sort of emergency or crisis, it would be almost impossible for them to get out because of the way that they're actually held on these flights. The airline staff only receive so much support and training to be able to respond to this. So it's seemingly a terrible, traumatic experience for everyone that is actually a part of these flights.
Do we know anything about the people that are being sent on these Avella flights? Based on past experience of folks being picked up, I'm guessing a lot of them have no criminal record.
Yeah, that's our assumption as well. So the thing that we do know is that they're the only known commercial airline that's taking these flights. And we know the types of folks who have been on them before, as mentioned before, because they're trying so hard to make sure that people don't know before the flights are going, when they're going. As we've seen, they have been taking folks who are actually legally able to stay in the country and putting them on ICE flights and sending them to various countries that they're not even from. So we are assuming that this is exactly the same case because we have seen evidence of that happening before. And that's why we're really working so hard to stop them. We think that there's a high likelihood that it's basically just kidnapping for profit. So we're not going to stop until Avella drops the contract.
That was Umi Hawk, an organizer with the Immigrant Protection Project, Defend and Recruit. Find more information about the Boycott Avella campaign and related commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXDR in New Orleans, Louisiana, KMRE in Bellingham, Washington, Progressive Voices Network nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.